Welcome to Designed for More, brought to you by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Join Dr. Timothy Jennings, a renowned expert in psychiatry, neuroscience, and spiritual well-being, as he explores the connections between mind, body, spirit, and relationships.
Hello, and welcome to Designed for More, sponsored by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. I'm Dr. Tim Jennings, joined today by Danielle Rome, one of our therapists here at Honey Lake, and Pastor James Johnson, our chief of chaplains. And today we're going to be talking about the case for God, the case for God. And we're going to be talking about, is there an irrational, evidence-based, scientific perspective that makes the case for God that's actually more rational than any other explanation? We will look at my goal at some point today as we get into this is to look at some stories in Scripture to see if they're actually scientifically consistent. But before we get there, if you were dealing with somebody who doesn't value the Bible, they might be a critic of the Bible, so they're not going to accept the Bible's word on things to start with. Do you think there's enough evidence in the natural world around us and how science works and so forth to make the case for God?
Absolutely.
And what would you say to somebody who asks, why do you believe in God?
Well, one of the things that I usually use as attack with, you know, people, especially if they are non-Christian or even, you know, anti-theistic, like they just don't want to, antagonist to faith in general, is to kind of ask them the four main questions of our worldview of origin, meaning, morality, and destiny. And if they start with, you know, some of the things about science, when, you know, we say, oh, well, you know, in the beginning there was nothing, and all of a sudden out of that nothing, thanks to what Einstein helped us figure out in the 1920s, the universe is expanding. So we know there was a starting point. Is one of the fundamental laws of science, the law of conservation of mass and energy, tells us that matter can't be created or destroyed, but yet we universally agree there was a time where there was nothing and matter came into existence. And so, you know, what is that uncaused cause? And does it make more sense to believe that there was something that was the cause, or that it just something came from nothing? And usually when I get to that point, it's almost, I mean, unless they just choose to not think rationally, it makes far more sense to think that somebody created the process of creating. You know,
I've never found that to help. Really? Every time I understand that argument. I don't disagree with it.
Right.
It's just that when I've presented that, the answer I got is, well, then who created God?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's what they'll say. And so, okay, fine, God created this, but who created him? And your answer is going to be, well, he always was. And you're going to go, what evidence do you have for that? And you can't prove that. And so you're just basically, so you have a belief that God was there to create it. And I have a belief that actually is something we don't know. Maybe it's a multiverse. Maybe there's some energy systems that we haven't been able to measure yet. But something on its own just blew up.
Right. So the ontological argument is the idea that the fact that things are here, that something had to put it into being. And so you're right. We could derive off of that and say, well, instead of God, there's other things. But that's usually where I start.
Right. So the question is, God being an intelligence, not a force.
Exactly.
Okay. They might say, well, I believe there's some force out there beyond our own universe, but it's not God. It's maybe it's, you know, like on Star Wars, a force that you can tap into, some energy system that eventually coalesced in some way that caused the Big Bang for our universe. And we live in a multiverse. There's lots of these out there and they keep expanding from one to another.
Sure.
Okay. What I just described would be a philosophical argument, mm-hmm. or you might say call it fantasy even. That you hear in the same way they hear you talking about the Bible.
Absolutely.
So my question is there actually objective evidence?
Sure.
That not just argues, but you could even say requires and proves there had to be an intelligent being behind life as we know it.
Right. And so you shift from the ontological, the existence and the purpose of things, to the teleological, as to how they have design and they fit together in a way that would not happen randomly unless there was some part of it. And then, of course, the cosmological argument, looking at the larger universe as well, those two tie in.
So what evidence have you found? So that one, what evidence have you found to be helpful? Any?
So you know, my strength isn't as much in all of the scientific evidence. So I usually go the direction of, well, more of the why are you questioning this so strongly or why are you so against this?
Mm-hmm.
And just wanting to know more about the person. And that's, of course, I'm a therapist, right? So I tend to lean more in that direction. But I've found that people that are really adamantly against or trying to prove it wrong, there's something else going on there, because we were created for God. The evidence that I see is in our heart's natural inclination to worship or to want a God to rescue us.
So I like where you're going with that, because that's a different line of argument, and I want to validate it. It's just not where we're going to investigate today, but I want to validate
right,
it. And because I've done this as well, when I hear this resistance to the idea of God, if the person is willing to engage in a conversation, I have some that absolutely will not. They get angry, in fact. But if they're willing to engage, I will often ask them to tell me about the God you don't believe in. Mm-hmm. And they will describe a deity that when they finish, I'm able to say every time, well, good for you, because I don't believe in that God either. Mm-hmm. In other words, they're resisting some characterization of God that is grotesque and untrustworthy and ought not to be believed in.
Mm-hmm.
And they have not really, in my view, heard the truth about whom I understand God to be, God of love. Mm-hmm. And so that's what they're resisting. And or they may have experiences like their priest molested them, and he's representative of God, and those trauma experiences connected with the religious organization and or religious upbringing has alienated and turned them off. I don't want anything to do with a God that would endorse this type of behavior or something like that.
Yep, yep. And,
okay.
You know, intellectualizing something and getting into the specific, debating the specifics can be a way of, you know, avoiding the
issue. Validating what you've done, what position you've taken, is you're looking at the psychological underpinnings to person's ability to process and appreciate information. What I'm and the biases and the prejudices that can come in to block people from being able to appreciate. What I want to do is see if there's actual objective evidence that an honest, objective mind, if the evidence itself speaks to and validates an intelligent creator. That's mm-hmm. what I'm looking for. If a person's to be honest, yes, that evidence is consistent with the only explanation possible that we are aware of is an intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's out there. I think there's lots of it. One of the ones that I find most persuasive. And you talked about the complexity of the design, how all things work together and so forth. I think that's a brilliant one. But for me, the most persuasive, and let's talk about this one, then we can add in others. Life as we know it, and it doesn't matter if you believe in God or not. This is any person who has any knowledge of life and science, life science, knows that life as we know it in all forms requires at least three elements. And the three elements are physical matter, energy, and coded information coded in the RNA or DNA of the organism. There is no life that we know of that exists without those three.
Mm.
And the godless scientists will acknowledge that. And coded information requires a coder. And all the godless theories that have been put forward in our school books, they all talk about some primordial soup in which there was this and that chemical and maybe a spark hit, and those sparks worked together to form a protein, and that randomly over time formed a DNA molecule or an RNA molecule. Okay, those DNA and RNA molecules stand analogy as letters in an alphabet. And so the random force theories, which frankly, scientifically don't work either. They're all artificial and they require an intelligence to create the primordial soup in order to spark to create. But even if you give them that, all you have are the letters of the alphabet. Letters of the alphabet do not randomly organize themselves into the Encyclopedia Britannica. They do not randomly form words, and those words do not randomly form sentences, and those sentences do not randomly form paragraphs and chapters that code information. Are you following? Coded information requires an intelligence. So even Charles Darwin, when he was doing his theory of explanation, came up with something that he termed vera causa. vera causa was this idea that when you are trying to explain things that have occurred in the past, then vera causa says you must posit an explanation that is known to be able to cause the effect in question. If there is an explanation that can cause the effect that you're trying to observe, then that is the explanation you need to offer, not make up a new one that has not been shown to cause the effect. And the only known cause of coded information is an intelligence. Mm. That's the only known cause. And if you look at randomness, and so if you think about computer coding, zeros and ones, the godless theory is random forces randomly brought the genetic material together until they formed functional proteins. Ask any programmer, will your program work better if we randomly throw in zeros and ones? Does anybody have that's possible? Is there anybody think that possibly throwing in random zeros and ones to the code improves the code? Without, I'm going to give you some data in a minute, but does anybody think that's actually reasonable? Random zeros and ones can improve the operating of your computer.
No.
No. In fact, you actually destroy the operation of the computer by randomly throwing in zeros and ones. It corrupts the system. That's corruption. So random mutations to the code do not evolve or improve things. It degrades things. And so, mathematicians call this the problem of combinatorial analysis. And the last things you want is random things coming to code, because the more of that you get, the more problems you get, not the more problems you solve. And the reason for this is because when you put things in randomly, there's infinitely more random ways for things to go wrong than there are for things to go right. If you think about forming words with random letters of the alphabet, and you keep shaking up the letters and throwing them out, there's way more options for things to spell meaningless gibberish than there is to have meaningful information. And so mathematicians have actually calculated the rarity of a functional to non-functional random arrangement of a small sequence of amino acids to form a protein only 150 amino acids long. That's a small protein, just 150. And how many functional to non-functional random arrangements? For every one functional random arrangement of 150 amino acids, you have 10 to the 77th power non-functional random arrangements. To put that in context, because that has no meaning to you, 10 to the 77th. That's 10 followed by 77 zeros.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. That's 1 to 10 to that number. That number is so big that in our Milky Way galaxy, there's only 10 to the 65th power atoms in the entire galaxy.
Oh, wow.
Meaning that if you did a random search, there's not enough atoms in our galaxy to actually search a search problem of 10 to the 77th magnitude. Hmm. And there's in 4 billion years of life, if you believe life has been on Earth for 4 billion years, there's only 10 to the 40th organisms in the history of the planet. But to get one functional amino acid, it's one random event out of 10 to the 77. There's not enough organisms for the random event to actually have occurred in. Mm. Are you following the math here?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. This is mathematics. This is how reality works. You can't randomly, that's it. And 150 amino acid long protein is not life. Mm-hmm. You actually have to have life. You have to have a whole bunch of other proteins, messengers, signalers, molecules, all functioning simultaneously from the, if you had actually had a DNA sequence, one of our DNA sequences is not life. you actually have to have the translation DNA, the messenger, actually translation RNA, messenger RNA, the ribosomes, and all the other connecting and communicating molecules have to be there in order to take that information to produce something.
Mm. Yeah.
And all of that. I mean, are you seeing the magnitude of this problem?
Yeah.
Okay. So it is overwhelmingly scientifically provable that life as we know it requires an intelligence. Mm-hmm. Now, you can argue of what, you know, who that intelligence is, what's the quality of that intelligence, is it the God that we know from the Bible or something else? But there's really no good argument that these things happened in a non-intelligent way. So I'm going to pause there and see what questions you have. I find that refreshing and powerful.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. Of course, my mind is thinking about, okay, but if they're all, okay, you know, 10 to the 60-somethingth power atoms, then, okay, it's that multiplied by however many seconds and how many randomized things are happening a second. And maybe it is possible because of, like, how many seconds go into that period of time and how many randomized events are happening in each second.
Yeah, that's why I did the over 4 billion years of Earth's history. There hasn't even been, there's only been 10 to the 40th life forms in that 40 billion years. So that time frame doesn't even give you the time for 10 to the 77th power forms to actually form.
But that's only if there's, like, are you saying there'd be one random event a second?
No.
You don't know how many random events would happen. I'm just throwing out, you know, hypothetical, like,
yeah, so
arguments that are kind of going in my mind.
Yeah, so I guess I'm not tracking the argument.
So she's saying if you just had enough time, because, you know, the whole argument usually is time plus matter plus chance makes everything see here.
Again, so, 1 to 10 to the 77,
right.
4 billion years, mm-hmm. there's been 10 to the 40th.
Organisms.
But she's saying, like, before that we started counting time, who knows how much time existed before the random things came together.
Well, what I'm saying is we don't even know how many random events would happen a second or a millisecond. So how can we actually calculate?
Yeah. So are you saying that you think it's reasonable that randomness organizes information?
I don't know.
You really don't know?
That in the...
Really?
That's where there's limitations in my understanding of the science. And what you're saying, maybe I'm not understanding it, but it's, I'm like, hearing some holes in it.
Well, taking a pot and putting all the alphabet into it.
I'm just throwing out hypothetical arguments that people might be thinking. Yeah.
No. So I don't think we're connecting then. Mm-hmm. I don't think you're understanding what I'm saying.
Okay.
Are you saying that we could take the 26 letters of our alphabet and with enough time, having them just circulate in a mixer, that eventually, all by their own, without any intelligence, what'll come out is the Encyclopedia Britannica?
I think if you're using that analogy, no. But analogies don't always work for everything. So theoretically, in your analogy, correct, you wouldn't be able to get
that. But that is what we're talking about, coding information. But
is that a direct...
Are you aware of any random force, random? You understand what random means? No intelligence that codes information.
No.
Okay, vera causa.
Right.
Okay. So what we're looking for is cause and effect and what we can actually show scientifically, not fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no scientific. So if we're going with the science, evidence, measurable, provable, what's science is something observable, measurable, reproducible.
Right.
And with observable, measurable, and reproducible, is there any random observable, measurable, reproducible event that codes information?
Yeah, not that I know of. Yeah. And I think that I'm on board with you. I'm throwing out hypothetical arguments that are coming in my mind.
And hypotheses need to be tested.
Yes.
So, and what one of the, I had a professor who tried this game, but the math pretty much disproves it now. Because I use the argument of the second law of thermodynamics that things tend toward disorder, not towards order. And he said, well, but that's in the whole system. So if Earth, things are getting ordered on Earth, that's being balanced by disorder somewhere else in the universe. Do you see how he can just avoided the responsibility there? Okay. So this idea, well, something might happen somewhere. That's actually not science.
Right.
That's not even a hypothesis. That's an evasion of what evidence we have.
And that touches on what I was saying earlier, where there's bias. And so the argument that things can happen randomly is being made by somebody who's leaning in the direction of wanting to disprove God rather than seeking with curiosity how God designed things. So that's where there's the element of where somebody's coming from. Mm-hmm. Psychologically.
So if you've been reading the scientific literature across the landscape from astrophysics to physics to genetic science, the people who are not trying to protect their funding, who are just being honest with the science, across the landscape are all coming out that they can no longer support neo-Darwinism and the Big Bang of without an intelligence. Everything that they're seeing requires intelligence behind it, from the the coded information in all living organisms to the multiple simultaneously required. For instance, even if you threw out the 150, and this was only 150 amino acid protein, that is numbers. If you expand that up to the human DNA with billions of, it's so much more.
Right.
Okay, but even if you have the DNA, then you have to have the RNA. You have to have all of these connecting molecules that have to be in existence and operating at the very time, or else the DNA molecule degrades. And then they all have to be there simultaneously.
Yeah.
Or else you can't have life.
Yeah.
And so you can't have this millions of years to have a DNA molecule form, and then millions of years more for the messenger molecules to form. It degrades.
Yep.
Okay. So all of the evidence for anybody who's actually honest requires there's some intelligence is behind this. Now the question is the Bible record a reliable record of that intelligence or not? And also let's look at some other data. You're familiar with Darwin's finches? You remember the finches with the different beaks? And he argued that the different beaks came because of mutation in the DNA over, thousands, if not millions of years, that allowed for adaptation. Some with grubs in the earth and some with the bark and so forth, because the beaks were more adapted.
Yeah.
And I actually have respect for Darwin, because he observed something and he made a hypothesis. The problem was he made an hypothesis when there was no scientific technology to test his hypothesis. We live in an era where his hypothesis is completely testable. We live in an era where we can genetically test these finches, and they've been done. And guess what? They're genetically identical. There's no mutations in the DNA sequences.
No.
That these beak changes are epigenetic modifications that happen in one or two generations based on environmental condition changes.
So it's adaptation, not...
Adaptations, not speciation. And the adaptation is what the biblical record teaches. The sins passed down 3 and 4 generations. Yep. These are adaptations to environmental pressures. Adam and Eve were created with the ability to create beings in their image, not just genetic sequences, but our life decisions. Our epigenetic science shows that our decisions in life alter how our genes are expressed. We pass along the same sequences, but also we pass on modifiers, how those sequences are modified. That's what you're seeing with the beaks. Yep. So that's consistent with the biblical story. Another story. I'm going to share this one to you. It's the Bible, because many, many scientists criticized, when they became scientific, the Bible for stories like this. This is out of Genesis 30, 37 to 39. The story is Jacob is working for his uncle Laban, and he's negotiating his salary. And Jacob negotiates that all the new goat and sheep that are born with speckles and stripes and spots go to him. All the solid fur ones go to Laban. Mm-hmm. And that's how he's going to be paid. And then this is what we read. Jacob does a strange thing when let me find the text where it starts. Okay, here it is. Jacob, however, took fresh cut branches from a poplar and almond and plane trees and made white stripes on them by peeling the bark and exposing the white inner wood of the branches. This is the Bible. Then he placed the peeled branches in the watering troughs so that they could be directly in front of the flocks when they came to drink. When the flocks were in heat and came to drink, they mated in front of the branches, and they bore young that were streaked, speckled, and spotted.
Interesting.
And you read that and go, come on.
Yeah.
What's going on? This is magic, or God's performing a miracle. Or no, actually, what we have actually proven and science has shown, and they've actually done the study, there's a gene called the agouti gene. And when the agouti gene is turned on, the offspring, what's mice, a mouse, a rat, or whatever, will be solid furred, when the gene is turned off, the solid furred in one color. And the mice studies and says the mice were blonde. And if they turned the gene off, the mice are solid furred in at brown. It changes the color. Mm-hmm. However, you can get partial penetrance, meaning some of the cells have it turned on and some of the cells have it turned off. And when that happens, then the animals are speckled, spotted, and striped. And what turns the agouti gene on are methyl groups. It will turn it off. When you put methyl groups on it, methyl will attach to that particular gene and alters, and you get the speckled, spotted, and striped things. And they've done the studies that these particular branches he put in the water donate methyl groups. They drink the water with the methyl groups, and it changes the expression of the fur.
Whoa.
It's epigenetic modification going on. So the Bible is, yes, so the Bible is genetically, scientifically correct in this story. That gives me confidence.
Yeah, that's
okay.
Interesting.
How about this, another genetic one? If you were an ancient, non-scientific person, you know, Abraham or Jacob or any of these people with no real scientific training, and you're observing the world around you, let's say Moses, who came after that, and he had the education of Egypt. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't really call that scientific, but he had the education of Egypt, maybe in mathematics and geometry and construction, but probably not in biological sciences. Mm-hmm. Where in society, in the world, would an ancient observe men giving birth to children? That's not observable in nature, is it? But the Bible says in Genesis that God made a male. And from that male, he took a female. Mm-hmm. Isn't that how the Bible story goes? He made Adam, and from Adam, he made Eve. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're writing up a made-up story from your observations as a human being on earth, is that how you would have written it?
True, yeah.
But is it scientifically true it could happen that way? You see, A male, to be a male, you have an X and a Y chromosome.
Mm-hmm.
To be a female, you have an X, and you have two X's, mm-hmm. but one of them gets turned into a bar body, means it's turned off and it's inoperable. So in every woman's cell, she only has one X operating. The other one's not operating. Mm. It's turned off.
Interesting.
It doesn't get used. So a woman alone does not have the genetic information to make a male because she has no Y chromosome. You can't get a male from a woman.
Interesting.
But a man has all the genetic information to make a woman if you don't transfer over the Y.
Interesting.
That's science. That's reality. That's how the story goes. And then the two together gives an X. You get a woman, and only every single, I don't know if you know this, but in a woman's body, she has two X's, one from mom, one from dad. Every cell in her body randomly decides which one will use. And so in your body, basically, mathematically, half of the cells in your body are using the one from dad, and half the cells in your body are using the one from mom. This is one of the theoretical reasons why women have a little bit more autoimmune diseases than men, is because they have slightly little genetic variations because of the differences in the contribution of the two X chromosomes. Also, color blindness is coded on your X chromosome. Mm-hmm. Women are rarely colorblind.
Yeah.
But men are more colorblind because they only have one X. Women have two X's. And in the retina, the retinal cells randomly pick mom or dad. If you have a dad that's colorblind, and they've done studies on women whose dads are colorblind, that she gets a colorblind gene on her dad's X chromosome. She's not colorblind, but when they take laser precision instruments to test the color of individual cells in her retina, some of those cells are colorblind. But other ones are not, because she has the ones with mods working in her retina. So she's not colorblind functionally, but she has individual cells that are colorblind. My point being is, it demonstrates that only one X chromosome is in operation in each cell. And so Eve could have come from Adam.
Interesting.
It is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. The other theory genetically for that I think the Bible's consistent on is that the godless theory teaches that random mutations are happening, and random mutations evolve or improve the species. Genetic science shows that with every generation, there are a minimum of 1,000 new mutations in your DNA that your parents didn't have. I have 1,000 more than my parents, 2,000 more than my grandparents, 3,000 more than my great-grandparents. Every generation has a minimum of at least 1,000 new mutations at birth. And then through your life, you add more through life experiences. And not one mutation thus far has been identified to actually improve the species or add information. All of them are damaging.
Interesting.
So that's genetic science. So the science is consistent with what the Bible taught, that if you eat, the day you eat, you will die and you will die. You will decay and die. That we're degrading over time. We're not evolving to higher life forms. And people say, wait a second, though, we're living longer than ever. Yeah, we're living longer than ever from the last 120 years or so because of sanitation, antibiotics, modern medical science, but we're not actually getting genetically stronger and more vibrant as human beings on a genetic level.
Yeah, and we're building our intelligence based off of all of the intelligence and research people did before us. So we're not reinventing the wheel with every generation.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So anyway, so I find all that. Now, so all that is actually stuff that's measurable.
Yeah,
and then,
that's cool.
And then the other idea are the design laws, like the law of love built into, this is measurable.
Yeah.
Every breath you take, you have carbon dioxide and the plants give oxygen back to you. This never-ending circle of living built right into reality. Mm-hmm. The laws of exertion, the law of worship, the law. I mean, all these design laws upon which life and reality are built, these are also testable and reproducible. And when you expose those, and these are the moral laws. You can't have love while violating the laws of liberty. You will destroy love and incite rebellion. Mm-hmm. Individuality doesn't develop without freedom.
Yep.
So all these other moral aspects are also testable, and they're not evolutionarily driven.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And in fact, most of the time, they're counter to what, at least I learned in school, that you're supposed to have the survival of the fittest. A lot of our moral laws and coding actually goes against that. Rather than me stepping over somebody or hurting somebody to get what I want, it actually proves that it's healthier for love and belonging, relational liberty, all those things to actually do the opposite of that. Mm-hmm. And that's actually what brings health and well-being. And so it's counter to even at least what I was taught in school. Oh, if it's survival of the fittest, I should hurt other people to get what I want rather than nurturing healthy relationships.
So it really takes a lot more what it's called blind faith, not an informed and intelligent faith, to believe in a godless world and a godless origins than to believe in an intelligent God of love.
That's right.
But the evidence is so overwhelming for people who are honest with the evidence that these things did not come by random forces, that we're here, we have a purpose, we have a designer, we have a creator who loves us, and we have a purpose beyond this world. And when we understand that, then we can start studying and researching what is that purpose, what is that calling, and then make intelligent choices to harmonize with those principles, those designs, and we can have the vibrant life designed for more. We're designed for more than this world offers us. Yeah. And that's what we want our listeners to know.
Yeah.
Other thoughts you want to share on this topic today, guys?
I just want to encourage people to seek, right? Like, if it's true, it should be testable, right? That's something that you say. And it's seek and you will find, knock and the door will be open. So people that I've met that are genuinely wanting to find truth stumble, find their way to God being creator. Anybody that I've met that's genuinely seeking. And so anybody that's listening to this that maybe doesn't really know where they stand, okay, look for it. Look for it with an open heart. And if you're really wanting to find the truth and you're looking at all of the evidence, then you'll find it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the thing that really, you know, cinched it for me when I was a young, you know, 19, 20 something, and I had a crisis of faith, it was the evidence that led me to a belief in God, but it was the evidence of the provability of the Bible that you mentioned and the resurrection of Jesus that brought me to the Christian God. And only the Christian worldview actually answers the problems of evil and reality and the human experience. So when you put all of that together, if you have that open mind, I don't see how you could not come to not just a belief in God, but a belief in the Christian God.
Yeah, and the Bible is incredible when it's read through the right lens. Mm-hmm. What I mean by the right lens is God's laws are design laws. If you read the Bible through the human law lens, a system of rules with an imperial dictator who'll punish you for breaking, it can actually turn you away from God and the belief in God. You want to live in a godless world.
Yeah.
And that's part of the problem. And I think
what led to the godless theories of origin was the Dark Ages, with the authoritarian inquisitorial church that burned people at the stake and imprisoned Galileo for actually making observations of the world and the solar system around him. That is a turnoff. It's a violation of liberty. It's a violation of objective reality. And the natural godly result of that is to rebel against it. But sadly, they rebelled not by pursuing the truth, but by rejecting the idea of a God.
That's right.
Yeah. And I think that led to, you know, the whole godless evolutionary theories, because people didn't want to deal with a church that was so irrational and fraudulent in what they were actually teaching, and contrary to how life and health actually works.
That's yeah. right. Absolutely.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us today. I hope this program was helpful for you. If you have questions, send those into questions@designformore.net, and we'll see you next time. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for joining us on Designed for More, brought to you by Come and Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Also, don't forget to check out our other podcasts for more inspiring content.